Well, good afternoon. I'm Bernie Weintraub. It's my third year of being president of the Conference of Emeritus Members, and hopefully my last. But I think we have a new president coming finally, and so that's kind of a relief to know that that's going to happen. I'm so delighted, because one of my responsibilities was always to find the scientific session speaker. Unfortunately, I know enough people, this lady being one of them, who volunteer to help out and who will make the greatest presentation that I know we're going to have in this entire session, except for maybe what happened yesterday at the opening session. Anyhow, Diana Bont, I think many of you know, and those of you who don't, she is Vice President of Public Affairs and directs the Kaiser Permanente Southern California Public Policy Agenda and Community Benefits Program, in addition to providing leadership for Kaiser Permanente's community, government, media relations, and corporate communications. It's a heck of a lot of work that she does, and I'm so grateful that she has this job because she's been able to help some of the various community programs that we've been involved in, and we have somebody we can go to when we think there's a worthy cause, and she's been there to help us. Before joining Kaiser, Diana was director of the California Department of Health Services, and before that she was director of the Department of Health and Human Services for the City of Long Beach. So the next step up would have to be some at the federal level, like Vice President of the United States or something, I suppose. Dr. Bonta serves as national leader in public health issues and is on the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services Advisory Committee on Minority Health. And she's a trustee of the Annie E. Casey Foundation, working to improve the lives of vulnerable children and families. It's one of the happiest things she has, is being able to work with the Annie Casey Foundation. She tells me it's one of her high points of her career. Diana was awarded the American Public Health Association's Presidential Citation Award, the Milton and Ruth Romer Prize for Creative Local Public Health Work, and the National Hispanic Medical Association Leadership Award. And she was also the former chair of the Executive Committee for the American Public Health Association. So she brings a wide spectrum of experiences to her. She received a doctorate and master's in public health from the University of California of Los Angeles, where she's now an adjunct associate professor because she doesn't have enough to do. She also holds a bachelor's degree in nursing from New York State University in Buffalo. So with those little bit of credentials, Diana, it's all yours, and thank you.
So good afternoon, everyone. So we're going to have some fun this afternoon. When Bernie was asking about this, was with a little bit of trepidation when he said, I said, where's the panel? And he said, no, you're the panel. And so I figured that I needed to not only give you some good thoughts, but to entertain you. So I have a lot of videos embedded in this. And you know what's the sign of someone that's doing a lot of videos? They sort of do this, you know. But I know that with APHA's guidance that it's going to all work. I want to say that it's truly an honor to be here. I mean, every time I come to APHA conferences, and I've been coming since 1975, you know, you never walk away other than inspired, and certainly the opening and throughout the many, many days and the closing ceremonies as well. I think it uplifts all of us for the rest of the year, right? And especially in very difficult times. So this is a wonderful opportunity. I want to give my kudos also to Bernie Weintraub because, I mean, he's just amazing, truly amazing. You know, he started his early days in environmental health. I remember him working with Los Angeles County for many years. He was ahead of his time, certainly in all the areas of environmental health. But he's evolved over the years, and he's been involved in oral health. He's been involved in senior issues. He's vivacious, tenacious, engaged, and he makes things happen. And he does it in a wonderful, collegial manner in which he says, don't you think you should maybe think about such and such? And you might at times say, well, I'm not sure, Bernie, we can do that. But you get back to it later and you say, he's right, we need to do this. So I hope that we just have clones of him, and I know his granddaughter Rachel has been here as well, because his involvement on the Los Angeles Council on Aging is now creating a new energy for seniors in very difficult times to be able to expand their opportunities for good health into their 80s, 90s, and we have so many people celebrating their 100th birthdays as well. So I'd like you to start this presentation with applause for Bernie Weintraub and the energy he brings. And like Bernie, so many of you in this audience, and I recognize many of you, you have been dedicated to public health for many, many years. So my admiration for all of you, and it's great to have you as colleagues, and to think that we can together forge new alliances and make new things happen. Well, you know, this has been really a whirlwind year in terms of health reform. And we're again, mindful that we still have a ways to go in terms of the Senate. Right now, we're going to be hearing for the next several months, and, you know, the pundits are already saying, you know, can this be done before the holidays? And so I'm still banking that we're going to see health reform. And I think that many of us are mindful that this will be certainly the step in the right direction. But it's not the only thing. You know, when you really think about health reform, it's only a step towards a healthier nation. And it will address the payment system. It will address providing insurance and coverage options. But can it truly create a healthier U.S.? Not unless we couple it with other improvements in the community. And the changes at the federal level will provide that framework, I think, for improving the health of the nation. But we really need to look at changes at the local level, at the community level, at policies that deal with where we live, where we work, where we play, right? And so today I want to address some of that with you. Now, you might feel like the presentation is Kaiser-centric. I hope you won't by the end of it. But it was easier for me to use that as illustrations because I'm working at Kaiser. I want to really look at the intersection, though, and the title of this is The Changing Tides of Public Health and Nonprofit Organizations, because I'm looking at the intersection between public health providers, community-based organizations, nonprofits, and private entities such as Kaiser, because all of that has to gel together. Now, Bernie mentioned that I come from a public health background, and I'd say my finest time of what I enjoyed was working for the city of Long Beach for almost 11 years, because it was with the city council, and it was health and human services, so the kinds of things to look at. Not just a health delivery system and a public health system, but to look at social services, which involve programs for the homeless, drug, alcohol, rehab services, social services in the community as well. And then I went on to the state of California, not an easy job, for about 4.5 years, which was just massive in trying to get about just some semblance of responsible stewardship of our public health system in the state of California. And it's, you can imagine, it was very large at the time. We had a budget of in the billions, and it took me years to be able to even articulate, just in the Medicaid program was $36 billion of operation. And then in the public health system, another $8 billion. And this was, when I left, was January of 2004. So it's increased over those years. Yet, I think we find ourselves saying, has it improved healthcare? I mean, we can spend more money, but do we actually improve the health that people are facing? Well, I've been very fortunate then, as I sort of cycle through those jobs, to be able to work with Kaiser Permanente. And I say that because at first I was very hesitant about joining Kaiser. You know, I'd come from a public health model. Here was a corporate world, and though it's a not-for-profit, it just felt different. But I've been very pleased in the last 5 years to have an opportunity to take what I've learned from public health and to join colleagues at Kaiser, and Denise Schaefer is here, Gwen Leakes-Isaacs is here from Southern California as well, and as colleagues, they have a passion as well for public health and for the community. Many of you might know Ray Baxter, for instance, and Ray Baxter is head of our community benefits program in on a national basis. And Ray Baxter was the former director of health for the City County of San Francisco during the time of the first recognition of HIV/AIDS. And so he really was at the forefront of so many community issues. And then I've also been very fortunate that the president of Kaiser Permanente in Southern California is someone that many of my colleagues know. I'm going to have to talk louder, I think. And let me know in the back if you can't hear me, is Dr. Benjamin Chu. And Dr. Chu is the former head of the New York City Health and Hospitals Corporation. Again, very strong public health background. So in many ways, they've made it easy for me to be able to dream in Kaiser about these opportunities and to actually put it into play. So Kaiser is deeply rooted in the idea of what we call total community health. And we recognize that it's truly important in order for us to make an impact in health, that we have to really be able to bring that to the community, not just to the Kaiser members. And that we know that to achieve this goal, we must form partnerships with public health departments, with community organizations, with safety net providers, and with other not-for-profit organizations, because we're all working really towards the same end. And we're focused on prevention, and we believe that prevention begins with healthy environments. And what does that mean? It means fresh fruits and vegetables, it means safe neighborhoods, it means great schools where kids can learn, it means clean air, it means accessible parks, and safe playgrounds. So yesterday you had an opportunity at the opening that Bernie mentioned, which is always spectacular, and they had a short video. Most of you saw that yesterday, and it talked about in one generation the changes we can make. And in that, they were showing and talking about helmets for protection and fruits and vegetables and, you know, the kinds of things that it's a very positive energy. I mean, years ago we used to say, don't smoke, which we still do, which is important, but we've gotten away from the don'ts, right? And it's more of the do's. How do you have that personal sense of health? So I thought I'd start out with a video that just very quickly shows you kind of a fun way that we're looking at this through Kaiser. So good health for everyone. So are many of you familiar with Kaiser? Do I get like head nods? Yes? Okay, great. So I won't go in length as to what we are. I'll just sort of make a summary statement that started in 1945. To me, that was a surprise when I joined, that it's that old an organization. 8.6 million members now, the majority in California, about 6 million in California. We're in 8 regions, and just for a sense of magnitude, 35 hospitals are operated throughout the country. There's some more seats in the front if any of you that are standing want to be a little bit more comfortable. I'm going to focus on community benefit, and it's been our strategy in community benefit, as I said, to focus on total community health. And in 2008, we actually funded at a total of $1 billion in programs in the community and partnership with the community, because we felt that this was extremely important. Now, our priorities are based upon, oops, I don't want to do that. Well, maybe you're going to see it twice. I'm sorry about that. Okay, good. So what I'm talking about then on a national basis is to look at some of the work that we've done in our community health initiatives, our safety net partnerships, and that includes, as I mentioned before, federally qualified health agencies, community clinics, public hospitals, public health departments, care and coverage for low-income individuals, and developing and disseminating knowledge. And we're really looking at long-term relationships that involve more than just one-time funding or quick fixes. Now, that doesn't mean that we don't have some funding that we do for leadership development that's one-time only or other kinds of projects in that area. But we've mainly been trying to focus in this area, and I'll give you some examples in this presentation of what we're doing. Now, over the years, we've had our challenges and we've had our successes, like any organization, and we've learned a lot. And today, as part of this, you know, I want to talk about these intersections. And later in this session, I really want to get your assistance, because so many of you are emeritus members and have been longtime members of APHA, and that you have wonderful ideas about what can be done in the community, and not just for Kaiser, but just in totality for the community. So it used to be in the past that, let's see if I can get this to go one more. It used to be in the past that we would sponsor health fairs and we would get our mobile vans out into the community. And while valuable, we know that these strategies are not enough, right? So we really need medical homes for individuals in the community to be able to go to access care and coverage in the community. And though we participate in the Medicaid program, we have Healthy Families, the SCHIP program in California, we've been able to provide services that way. We also know that we need to support community agencies, because the majority of low-income individuals who are underinsured or who don't have insurance are supported by these community agencies. And we're also providing many times capital for buildings for organizations, because many community agencies, they've been 40, 50 years in the same buildings. They need renovations. So we don't shy away from that in terms of on a need basis, also providing funding for capital. We train physicians, nurses, other allied health individuals, and professionals to work in community agencies. And I know I was telling Bernie recently that we placed nurse practitioners actually in clinics in San Diego area. These are Kaiser employees that are working full-time in a community agency. We pay their salary, and they're seeing patients right in that agency, because we felt it was a good fit. It's a year-long fellowship, so it's an honor for the Kaiser Permanente nurses to actually serve in the community. Now, there's a city in Los Angeles called Cudahy. It's a small city in southeastern Los Angeles County. It's a community with a high number of low-income, uninsured Latino residents who experience a very high incidence of diabetes and cardiovascular disease. And within Cudahy, there's an organization called the John Wesley Community Health Institute, JWCH. And it's an agency that provides primary care and services as a medical home for the community. And its patients include diabetic patients at the high-risk end of the spectrum due to previous lack of care, or they have, certainly some of them are non-compliant in their care. Well, Kaiser recently opened a medical office building in Cudahy. And the physician said, we want to open our building to non-members, people who are not members of Kaiser in the community. And so we thought the best way to do that, rather than sort of say anybody come in to the Kaiser facility on any day of the week, would be to partner with a community agency. So John Wesley we went to and we said, how can we help you by Kaiser partnering with you? And they said, you know, it'd be great if we had the opportunity to co-manage our diabetic patients that are non-compliant. And so we've come together to do that. John Wesley still continues to be that medical home for continuing primary care, education, social services, and Kaiser's providing the physician office visits, case management services with our nurses, classes with our health educators, and one-to-one consultation with our nutritionists, as well as the necessary labs, diagnostic imaging, and medications. And in order to make this more simple. There are no bills to the patient. There is no bills to the community clinic. It's a service that we're trying to provide. Now, it's a new pilot program, and it's not without its challenges. You know, we have a very wonderful Health Connect, and I'll talk a little bit about our data system in this presentation. But we still haven't worked out all the logistics of having one medical record, so we're going to have to keep multiple systems in place till we sort of gel that out a little bit more. But we are seeing that our physicians are able to share their specialty care experience and their expertise of working in a very large system with many diabetic patients to the John Wesley physicians who may not have as many patients that they are managing in this area. And at the same time, the Kaiser physicians are learning from the community agency. They're learning about the social problems, the issues that people in the community are facing, and it helps their discipline, helps them when they are servicing members or non-members. Now, based on both the clinical and process outcomes of this partnership, we hope we will have the opportunity to improve it and to replicate it. And in South Los Angeles, just this week, we had a groundbreaking to start actually building a new Kaiser Medical Office building in South LA. And we want to replicate this model. We'll opening it up, our clinic there, to non-members and look again, ask them what would be the management that they'd like us to do jointly. Well, another partnership with the same agency, John Wesley Community Health, is on Skid Row. And this is a pretty unique project. I have a video that portrays it. But what we were looking at here is that many homeless were being seen at the clinic in a part of the community where it's an over-concentration of homeless. And the clinic had x-ray facilities and a technician who could take the x-ray. But they had nobody that could actually read the x-ray. And so they were sending them out. It was taking 4 weeks to get results. And I know there's a lot of clinicians in the room right now, and they know that frequently you will need a clearance to be able for a homeless person to be accepted into a shelter. So you need to have a clearance by x-ray that they don't have active tuberculosis. And so if you have to wait 4 weeks, it's a long delay in getting that patient into the center. So let me see if my logistics will work.
Special web-based digital x-ray system just for community clinics to ensure
Our physicians have really admired the dedication of the staff there at the agency. And, you know, it's by seeing it, that's why I thought the video, you know, it sort of brings it to life. You can't imagine the conditions on the street till you see something like this. And it's in every community, and there's these opportunities, I think, to make a difference. You know, when I was with Long Beach, Long Beach has about 40,000 Cambodians that have resettled from the early 80s on and post the war. And many of them came just having experienced just awful things in their lives, torture, war, separation with family. And the healing has to come inside out. And we have a new experience that we're seeing in Southern California. Los Angeles is among the top 3 points of entry for human trafficking. We've already seen cases, two in San Diego and other parts of Southern California. These are cases where people are brought in from Southeast Asia, parts of Africa, parts of Mexico, and they're enslaved. And they are out in the street in prostitution. They're in sweatshops. There is a group called the Coalition to Abolish Slavery and Trafficking. And it's an organization in Los Angeles that was formed in 1998 in response to the El Monte sweatshop case, where more than 70 workers were held in slavery and forced labor. I actually had the privilege of meeting these people. There was at the Asian Pacific Legal Center recently. They had, it's principally women, but some men, come out and be recognized by the community for their bravery and for these just incredibly inhumane conditions that they had suffered. Well, this coalition, this agency, is now including access to emergency and long-term care, coordinating access to mental and physical health, safe and appropriate housing, intensive case management that encompasses health, social, legal, outreach, and training services. Now, the coalition has a waiting list, and so they approached us for funding, and so the funding is allowing them to expand their services in the community. You know, when I was putting together this presentation, my staff was looking for a photo of these individuals and some of what they are experiencing on the street, and I said, no, I want a more positive photo. I want to show the healing. And so that's why I put this. It may not seem to fit, but to me it fits. It's that healing from the inside out. It's that through meditation, through whatever it takes, to be able to bring these individuals to the next place in their lives, to a positive place. This is what I mean by total health. They're not simple projects. They're not easy projects. And it really takes following the good sense of the community first and asking them, what is it that we can make a difference on in a small, modest way? And this is one of the very significant ways I feel that we can do this. So let's move on to obesity. And I know there's been a lot of sessions about obesity, and I want to just cover it briefly in terms of addressing it, again, from a community perspective. Now, at Kaiser, we have clinical protocols, and certainly we have management of individuals by the physicians. And we have a very diverse population, and certainly diverse in racial ethnic backgrounds, but also in income levels. And so, obesity cuts across all populations. But we're really also very mindful that we have to influence the environmental landscape, and our impact is limited on an individual basis. It's much more profound when you can bring it out to a whole community landscape. And we're finding that we can do some partnerships to address this through community safety and access to exercise areas and equipment, ensuring healthy food, but we can't do it alone. And our community partnerships certainly are one of the best resources for doing this. Now, our HEAL project, it's Healthy Eating, Active Living, and some of you are familiar with this project in California. We also have another cooperative with the California Endowment for HEAC, which is in the communities, designated communities, for, again, looking at the issues of obesity. So we're working very strongly with providing health industry leadership in these public forums, being there, testifying in different forums about the changes that have to occur, supporting our very many times brave elected officials when they get out there and they have bans on, you know, right now looking at the potential for soda bans in terms of those with high caloric content, looking at changes. These are abuelitas, the grandmothers in Belvedere Park, and this is looking at for seniors having equipment that they can use in the parks as well, and certainly for the young generation to provide some play spaces as well. About 3 years ago, almost 4 years ago, we were trying to develop a program that would have particularly Latino children have more exercise, and in what could we do in the community. You know, so many of the children live in neighborhoods that there's gang warfare in, it's not safe to go outside, there is no backyard, there is no front yard. There is no ability really to get out there and to have the kind of exercise that they should be, and then the schools have had to cut back on that. Or they're located, Mary Ellen knows, in the Long Beach area, we've had problems where the school's children couldn't be on the playground because they had exposure to coal dust from the trains going by, air is polluted. So it's all of these things. So we started to look at it. We talked to Latino adults, and we said, what is it in your childhood even? Because for them, some of these streets have not changed in 40 years. Where there was violence on the streets, even when they were youngsters. They said, well, you know, one of the most pleasurable things was a swimming pool in the summer, and we're blessed in California to have good weather. And so they said, you know, this was a time that they could play and enjoy learning how to swim. And so we started looking around and realizing that many of the public swimming pools were closed, or they had abbreviated hours of operation. The city couldn't afford chlorine. The city couldn't afford to hire lifeguards, so you have to close back on the hours. So we said, well, it doesn't sound too glamorous, but that would be a nice investment. And so we put in over $1 million, 44 swimming pools the first year, to be able to keep them open longer hours, pay for the chlorine, and pay for the lifeguards. Well, 3 years later, there are 31,000, mainly children, who've learned how to swim. They are getting exposed to a lifetime sport, right? Because they can continue this. Their families are feeling a little bit more easy about maybe moving out of the barrio and taking the kids to the ocean because it's safe, because the kid knows how to swim, right? The children are also finding an opportunity to be junior lifeguards, get a little money in the summertime. So this has been an incredible project. And I want to pick your brains about, you know, could there be other projects like this that we can think about? We've now actually expanded it to 8 sites within 6 counties. And it was interesting because in the second year of operation, the Recreation and Parks Department for the City of Los Angeles came to us and they said, you know what, you have nutritionists and dietitians, don't you? And we said, yeah. They said, well, you know, could you have those folks teach our community workers that work with children in the after-school programs and in the summer programs about how to do healthy meals? We said, sure. We trained 400 people in healthy meals. It was a fun one-day workshop that we were able to do that. The third year, we said, well, what else do you think we could help with? And they said, if you could please bring your educational theater program group, where they could do performances again for the kids, not only in the school, but in the summertime. So we started holding workshops for elementary school children, emphasizing portion control, healthy food choices, food preparation, and activities that are motivating kids to move more, to have fun, hula hoops, whatever it takes for kids to feel comfortable in moving. We're also influencing public policy. This is a teenager, and she was actually testifying in Sacramento, California's capital, and she was testifying in favor of a soda ban in public schools. And these young teenagers have been fantastic because they have been the ones that have been actually mapping out their communities. They go in a group and they look at where would be a safe route for a mile to walk. And then they've been also looking at community assets and liabilities. What do I mean by that? Well, they look at, you know, does the neighborhood bodega or convenience store, does it have cigarettes up in the front? Does it have, you know, junk food up in the front? And they've been able to work with partners in the community, with elected officials, with others to push, change that around, put the fruits in, you know, up in the front by the cash register so that you have some healthy choices as well. So these teenagers are pretty remarkable. They've also been working and advocating for healthy vending machines in the schools as well. So one of the things that last week I had an appointment with the mayor's office in the city of Los Angeles, and I was fortunate to be able to partner with Eileen Adams, who was looking at how can we sort of position for a more healthy community. One of the things that we talked about is, you know, there are neighborhood councils in the city. Now, what do they do? Well, they're involved with usually density issues and development issues. So I have one in my, I live in Los Angeles, and there's a neighborhood council, and they want to sort of block, multiple story overbuilding in the neighborhoods, and that's where they've concentrated their energy. Some neighborhood councils have been against changes in transportation, making one-way areas of commuting. They've also been involved in work with the police department for safety. That's certainly in neighborhoods a number one issue. And they've involved the fire department, for instance, in disaster preparedness. But they don't have anything on health. So I need your thoughts, keep thinking as I'm presenting, about what could be maybe some way to engage the neighborhood councils in health. Now, one concept goes back to this teenagers. One concept would be maybe to give some small motivating grants, $5,000, $10,000, to the neighborhood councils and say to them, can you map out a walking route in your community? And could we say in the city of Los Angeles that, I don't know, at 7 p.m., maybe we start it in the spring with a change of hours again, but 7 p.m., join the walking route. Here's the route. Join anywhere on the route. Maybe get the seniors out that are home by themselves the whole day to walk half a block, but they're doing that with their neighbors. It's an organizing tool for the neighborhood council, right, that they can talk with their neighbors. So some way to get people more engaged in this physical activity. You know, in Los Angeles, only a third of all children are within a walking distance of a public park. And so this is a photo on the left-hand side. This is a rail right-of-way that, is pretty ugly looking. And then what could happen, and in fact, this is the transfer of what did happen. And this is an organization called the Trust for Public Land. And it gives us a wonderful opportunity to increase eligibility for park bond money by completing green mapping, identifying land for parks and open spaces. They actually go out and canvas and look at where are their public right-of-ways, and with some infusion of money, can we make the transition to having more park space, especially in dense areas. You've got to look at conversions of land. We've been working with the League of Cities now. They have adopted this as well. So we're seeing nice changes in all kinds of communities that I think will make a significant difference. And this, again, is part of total health. Well, let me turn now to the Watts area. And Watts is another example of improving opportunities for the community to make healthier lifestyle choices. It's a community within South Los Angeles. Its residents have the lowest per capita income per household in the county. They also have the highest rate of diabetes, obesity, and deaths due to cardiovascular disease within the county. So it's a very significant area of need. Well, you can imagine there's not many exercise areas, and there really isn't many opportunities for people to have healthy choices in terms of buying food. There's hardly any marketplaces. They're certainly not in walking distance. And so we started thinking, and we have at the Kaiser Hospitals, we actually have on the hospital grounds, we have farmers markets. We invite the farmers to come in and have produce there. And it makes it easy for the doctors to say, you know, I'm going to write you a prescription for more exercise, and I want you to buy healthier foods, and the farmers market is here today, and go get something good to bring home. So we started looking about, could we bring this to Watts, where we don't have a hospital, but if we partnered with the community, could we do something like this? So here's an opportunity to look at the project.
The grand opening of the Watts Healthy Farmers Market is a huge step toward improving the health and nutrition of people living in South Los Angeles. A grant from Kaiser Permanente will help support the new weekly market until it can be self-sustained.
Makes you hungry, huh?
Kaiser Permanente Watts Counseling Learning Center has been here 40 years, and we
So this is a wonderful opportunity with the County of Los Angeles to partner together again. So I want to talk a little bit about the fact over the last 3 years we've been in a big construction mode in California because of the seismic safety requirements. And as a consequence, just in the last 3 years in Southern California, we have 6 brand new hospitals. So they're pretty impressive in terms of the buildings. We have what's called a 40-second rule that you're supposed to orient yourself 40 seconds after you go into the building, created with light space, use of natural light, having conference rooms that are accessible to the community. And we've learned to create what we call templates for hospitals, because if you're putting up hospitals that quickly, you want to be able to, you know, a pharmacy is so much square footage, and for efficiencies, you're going to duplicate that in the next one. Operating rooms are a certain setup, et cetera. So what we were finding when we talked with community agencies is that many of them need to be rebuilt, again, for seismic safety and for the number of patients that they're seeing. And so as a consequence, we were looking at how to create templates for these community agencies as well. This is one of them, the East Valley Community Health Clinic. And you can see the schematic in this is similar to what I was talking about in terms of open spaces, accessibility. Now, why is this important? Well, the agency, by us doing this, another agency can make modifications on it, make it their own unique setup, but they don't have to spend the same amount on an architect, on all of the planning. They know the process already, and it makes for money being able to be concentrated on seeing patients as opposed to some of the costs that are associated with construction. Here's a very short clip on, if I can find the cursor. We have another opportunity with the Asian Pacific Healthcare Venture. They came to us and they were saying that they needed to rehab their building. They wanted to put solar panels on the roof. We thought it was a good investment because through this, they're able to reduce the amount of money that they spend on their utilities. They're able to get rebates from the water department, from the gas department. And the most important thing, they're able to increase the number of patients that they're actually seeing in the community. So it's a good use of that resource as well. Well, I mentioned earlier about health technology, and I won't spend a whole lot of time on this because so many of you know that that is crucial when we're talking about health reform. That's been an important component of this. Bernie mentioned earlier that I serve on the Advisory Committee for Minority Health from DHHS. And one of the recent publications in July that I'll call your attention to is a publication on how to make sure that in health reform that we're including some of the principles that would be important for minority communities. And one of them is to have a robust data system. Why? Because we need to really make sure, particularly for patients that have dual diagnosis, complicated care, that their care is managed, integrated, that they're not repeating tests, that people that are different specialties are seeing the medical record and able to give the best quality of care, whether it's at a community agency, a public health department, or through the Kaiser system. Now, I know from having served in the public health department that the kind of money and investments that we put into this data system is not what's available in the public sector. And so as a consequence, we're trying to work together to prioritize what would be good ways that we could work together to enhance systems that public agencies. David Soulelis is here from Orange County Health Agency, and for instance, they're one of the ones that are looking at, you know, chronic disease management registries so that they can look at managing their patients as well. So we've entered into this arrangements to try and pull all of these agencies together for it. I'll give you one example that we used that I think is important to see in terms of how Kaiser used this data system. You know, we have a lot of fires in Southern California, wildfires. They're caused by the Santa Ana wind conditions, and then just somebody will, you know, carelessly dispose of a match and will start these huge fires that you see on television all the time. Well, through our data system at Kaiser, we're able geographically to isolate individuals with asthma, with chronic pulmonary disease. And then we're able to, they've indicated to us, how do they want to be contacted? Is it by text messaging, by email, by telephone calls? And so we'll contact all of the patients in the system and say, conditions are bad, air quality is very poor in your area. We're advising you, if at all possible, limit the time that you're outside. Certainly don't go jogging, don't go doing outdoor activities to the extent possible. And then we're also notifying them that if they had to be evacuated, here's the places where they can get their medication, and we open up certainly any center where they can do that. Well, think about that for public health departments. I mean, right now we're trying to get out the H1N1 vaccinations, right, to communities. And the more we can have systems that can allow the health department to identify who are the pregnant women with the highest risk, how can we outreach to individuals, children with chronic diseases? We know them, they're in our healthcare system. We should be able to call up and to notify parents that they're a priority, their children, for receiving services. So I think this is a way in which we can move this into the public sector in a very unique fashion. The ability for us to also get out there and work in the communities with training the next generation of health professionals is extremely important. And we've been working certainly with our residency programs and nursing and allied health in as an investment. It's truly what is needed. And one of the areas that we've been working on has been with community clinics to make sure that as we have physician residents in our program, that they're going out to community agencies. Venice Clinic is one of them, and here is Dr. Jimmy Hara. Too cute. Dr. Hara is actually chairman of the board of the Venice Community Clinic, and as he said, 35 years that he's been volunteering. He's just amazing, just the number of hours that he puts in and the kind of dedication. So I want quickly to tell you about this program also at UCLA in the Department of Family Medicine. And this is a very unique program. It's I think, one of the only ones in the United States. It's a program that allows international graduate medical physicians to provide, who are from bilingual in English and in Spanish, and that are dedicated to the care of underserved population. It provides them with a comprehensive program to pass the licensing examination and compete for family medicine residency positions in California. Now, they would have gotten their medical education outside of the US, and we're looking at ways in which many of them have been working in other capacities in a hospital, but they really want to practice as a physician. And this is an intensity of a program to help them get through some of the hurdles in front of them. The partnership is with Kaplan Higher Education Program. It actually coaches the international medical graduates through a multi-step licensing process, assistance and mentoring from the family medicine residency and faculty program. UCLA provides a stipend to these physicians. They get an opportunity certainly to hone their skills through observerships. And then they also make a commitment. They're required to work in an underserved urban or rural community in California for a minimum of 18 to 36 months. There's currently 20 international medical graduates enrolled in this family medicine residency program. So it's one to watch in terms of, is this something? Now, I have colleagues who say to me, well, Deanna, you know, what about the pipeline right here in the United States? And, you know, this is extremely important. Bob Montoya, and his daughter is here today, has spent his life really working on this. And so it's important to have the duality that we're looking at. Certainly enhancing what we're doing and to having culturally appropriate care being rendered by increasing the number of diverse faculty members and diverse number of students as well. We've also been working with a new program. This is UCLA Kaiser Permanente Center for Health Equity. And it's brand new. We're partnering in the School of Public Health to do research, community collaboration, and leadership development. And I'm hoping that next year at this conference, you're going to see some of the students from this program actually presenting. This is Dr. Rashan Bastani and Dr. Tony Yancey. Previously, the center was called the Center for Health Disparities. We all agreed that health equity was what we were aiming towards. It's been renamed and revitalized, and this will allow them to certainly expand in the community as well. So some of the new areas of focus through Bernie's nodding, pushing us in this direction has been through his work. He has been a board member of the California Dental Health Foundation, and they issued a report in 2006. The title of it is Mommy, It Hurts to Chew. And it really focuses on the dental disease epidemic among California's school children. Kids with severe decay of the mouth, they're often in pain. They can't study, they can't concentrate in school, and we're all trying to figure out why, and you know, any of us, you can't concentrate if you have pain. We have been trying to venture into this area. We don't have dentists except in Colorado area and in the Northwest. In California, we're not providing directly through Kaiser the dental services, but we felt that it was important for us to step into this area. And so it's been in a modest way. 28 agencies were given grants. 50,000 children had enhanced services for dental services for a two-year commitment. We've also looked at a program called Thriving Aging. And this is $1.6 million that we're looking at. Two phases of this. Phase one has been an initiative focused on policy research, analysis, advocacy, and support for caregivers. Phase two, grants target direct service efforts that primarily provide support for health and preservation of health-related quality of life for underserved older adults. It includes prevention activities, both physical and psychological treatments, and in addition, the direct service strategy focuses on community-based organizations that have established themselves as leaders and trusted partners so that it matches these health interventions to communities of color in culturally sensitive and appropriate ways. And so we've been fortunate to start out in this new venture. So I'm hoping that we can talk for a few minutes about some of what you've heard today. Maybe it sparks some ideas about areas that we should all venture into. Talk about some ideas from your own community. I'm never shy about copying something that's great, and that I'm sure many of you have seen some great projects in the last couple of days here at APHA, or you will be hearing about it. So I want you to be able to contact me if you hear about it. I want to close with what else? One more video. Just because we were talking about thriving aging, and you know, I just love this piece because it's what I think aging is about. Well, thank you for the opportunity to share with you today, and I look forward to a dialogue with you. Thank you again.
Well, very interesting, very interesting. I've learned a lot myself, so, and this is my neighbor. Anyhow, we have time for questions. We will have some refreshments in a short while. This is our scientific session, but it's also the where we get to honor our 40-year members. But in the meantime, those of you that have questions, let's hear them. Or comments. Yes. Are now they available?
So this really came about, you know, it's advertising and they're trying to really look at how to expand the Kaiser face. But I think what we were looking at is, you know, how do you capture sort of, instead of illness, how do you capture like that we should all be thriving to be everything we're capable of being? And so after a long time of back and forth and different opportunities and testing, they came up with this thrive and this sense of, you know, well-being. And that's articulated in all of the pieces now. Now, we have done some in illness as well. There's a beautiful piece on cancer. It's a woman that's undergoing radiation therapy, chemotherapy. But she says, you know, cancer doesn't have me. You know, I have life. And it's very moving as well. Try sometimes with comedy. If you see Kid Wisdom, it was a piece that we did with this little boy that is 5 years old, and he's quite pudgy, and he talks about how he's had bad living, you know, the drinking was too much, and he's guzzling this soda, and he said, and I ignored my relationships, and his dog is like, you know, there while he's doing the video. And so it captured again, you know, this spirit of, you know, even as little kids, when we're trying to talk about obesity, I mean, how can we make changes in there? And it's just been very captivating. So that's been it. It's been trial and error. And I think that APHA found a good one yesterday in terms of how it was articulating that video. It's in that similar vein, try not to be too preachy and at the same time move people toward the end. Because we believe in this, it's prevention, it's activities that will keep us well. And that's why in the first video it says, you know, it's not a card that's in your wallet. It's life, you know, and how do you support people going on with their lives? Yes.
Well, just a good comment on what I'm doing in my community, self-feeding.
Yes.
There's a ton of community gardening, and it's a great way of really
Good question. So I'll start with the community gardens. And yes, we're supportive of community gardens and have, you know, many times been working with the schools. Remember, I mentioned our educational theater program. They go out to the schools and actually spend, there are five different plays that they do, but one for the elementary school children is a week long. They do a play and then they're in the classroom and the kids are learning to eat broccoli and to start a community garden if one isn't there at the school already. There have been some good opportunities with the school bond measures, which we supported, to get money to the schools to actually have the community gardens in the schools. So that's been a wonderful way, and I applaud that you're doing that kind of work. You talked about promotoras, and we have Maria Lemos is in the back, if she could wave. And she's the one you want to talk to even more so. And Maria and I, we had the pleasure of working from way back when. The two of us were in rural health in California, which is one of our first jobs years ago. And we saw right then that as we were trying to establish community agencies in California through a piece of legislation in the late 70s, early 80s, that the way to do this was through laypersons who could get out into the community, had the language, had the skills, had the heart and soul to be able to work with individuals. And so the model started taking place. But we haven't supported it with the money. And when I was over the Medicaid program in California, Medi-Cal, you know, we were looking, was there a way to reimburse for services? But, you know, when you go broke, all those dreams go out the window, and I think so it's become more and more difficult to get funding for that. Now, Maria is working with actually expanding all the promotoras in the community. She's actually had a big function recently. She has major trainings that are done, and she's wonderful to speak with. We fund her project. She has other funding as well, but it's a proven model. It works. It's very effective. We're also trying in Kaiser. Our physicians have asked us, can we do it ourselves in terms of some of the partnership? Gwen Leakes-Isaacs, for instance, is working with high-risk Medicaid patients and looking at how can you have case management and integrate some of the ancillary and support staff that are integral for that. So there are two wonderful women to talk with a little bit later. I want to leave enough time for Bernie that we need a couple more minutes for the presentation. Any more time for questions, or should we move on?
No, we've got time.
We've got time? Okay. Yes. So for those who couldn't hear in the back, it was about in Toledo, a project in which the youth of the community have actually been allowing opportunities to go out to homes and to show that right in their own property that they can start a community garden because so many people didn't have access to fresh fruits and vegetables. And it's a wonderful model where we have land and people have access. Where they don't, it's to look at where are some trade-offs, how can we have different approaches to this. I grew up in New York City, and I never saw fresh fruits and vegetables. They were too expensive. My mother was from a Puerto Rican background, and they don't eat fruits and vegetables in Puerto Rico. Let me tell you, it's fried. And bacalao frito and wonderful, tasty things, but you know, the vegetables were yuca and heavy starches. And so her idea of fruits and vegetables, especially vegetables, were canned. And so you get nutritional value from canned produce as well, but how much better and how much better tasting? So when I came to California and tasted real stuff, it was quite a difference. And I think that's something we have to make sure that kids have that opportunity, because sometimes in their own household, they're not exposed to that. And the parents say, well, they'll never eat that. And that's where the surprises come. where we introduce these foods in the classroom and you know dip it in whatever, something that's not high caloric, but embellishes it. And you have opportunities then for kids to say, well, this is pretty good. So you're right, it's a great example. Yes. We haven't actually done that in terms of, because they're a private enterprise of sort of supporting that as a model, but it's been more the dialogue that these teenagers do and others do in the community to sort of change the placement of things, because what they also say is, you know, it spoils, and we said, well, yeah, it spoils because it's hidden in the back and nobody would ever think to purchase that, right? You get like impulse buying. You know, and it's whatever you see there, you suddenly crave chocolate because it's right there. But if you had some other choices, I mean, I thought coming out here by airplane from California, and I'm on the plane, right? And they don't serve you food now, but they serve you snacks. Have you ever seen an apple being served? A banana? You know, like, why can't they do that? Do you realize no one serves milk, right? The only thing is a little bit of milk to add to your coffee. And when I've asked them about this, well, it's perishable. We don't want any perishable foods. You know, they could make money on it. People would buy it. They're going up and down the aisles, you know, with pretzels and candy, and people are hungry. They didn't get a chance at the airport to pick up something. And they would eat vegetables and they would eat fruit, right? So I think we need to push that too, is say to the airlines, you know, where's the bananas? Where's the good thing? I do all the time. I pester them about it. I said, you know, they said, what would you like? I said, banana, an apple, you have any? And because they need to carry it back to their administration and say the customers, you know, passengers were asking for it on the plane, and why not? Why not experiment with it? Okay. I have little flyers here, and I can give you where the funding sources are with it. But I'd also, you know, I presented Kaiser because that's where I'm from. There are lots of other places out there as well that you need to explore, try and partner together. If you're from an agency that can do these partnerships, it's also, you know, we join in together with, sometimes with our competitors, sometimes with other organizations to do funding opportunities as well. So I have the site up here if you'd like to receive that. All right. Thank you again. Thank you, Bernie.
Thank you, Bernie. Thank you very much. One last thing before you go. Jay Glasser, one of our recent joiners of the Emeritus section, is working on a history of APHA. And for those of you that have been around a little while and have some ideas about it, there's going to be a session right after this one in room 106. But we have flyers here for those of you that might be interested in picking one of these up and taking a look at it and seeing what it is we're trying to do. APHA feels it's important that we maintain a chronology of our history so that we can look back and see where we've been, what we're doing now, as we plan to where we're going. And I think it's important that all of us think back to, you know, what is it that I know that APHA has done in my community or in my organization or in my affiliate or in my section that maybe they don't know about, and maybe we ought to have this written down someplace as part of the history of APHA. So thank you again for coming. It's been wonderful. Diana, thank you again, and thank you all for coming.